John Cage was a brilliant composer who wrote some of the most controversial music of the 20th century. There's the famous composition called 4 Minutes 33 Seconds, in which not a single note is played. There's a 5-hour multimedia extravaganza featuring 7 harpsichords, 52 tapes of computer-generated sounds, and 64 slide projectors. Writer Kenneth Silverman explores John Cage's life and music in a groundbreaking new biography called Begin Again. As Silverman told Steve Paulson, a lot of Cage's creativity came from his father, the inventor, John Milton Cage, Sr.
You know, when Cage was studying with Arnold Schoenberg in California, Schoenberg said about Cage, he said, he's not a composer, he's an inventor of genius. As Cage recognized, there's a lot of his father's inventiveness in Cage.
Mm-hmm. Now, from a very early age, Cage was drawn to new ways of thinking about art, what we might call the avant-garde. What was he reacting against?
Well, at different times, he was reacting against different things. Early on, like a lot of other people, he was reacting against romanticism, you know, this kind of emotionality in the arts, in poetry, composing, and so on. That was not at all, of course, a novel thing at the time that Cage started out. You know, people like T.S. Eliot and James Joyce, they were all reacting against romantic writing. I think Eliot said, Joyce, I guess it was, said, you know, the writer is in the wings just watching the action. Eliot insisted on impersonality. The writing isn't about you, it's about something else. You don't use your writing to express your personality. Cage entirely took that over and felt that music should, you know, contra Beethoven, whom he called a toilet paper. Contra Beethoven, music does not express emotion. It expresses sound.
So maybe it wasn't surprising then that he gravitated in his 20s to the modern composer Schoenberg. In fact, he studied with Schoenberg.
He did study with Schoenberg in California, got to know him pretty well. Schoenberg had him personally over to his house. It was a couple of times he chauffeured Schoenberg and his wife around in a car. The thing that Schoenberg really taught him, he decided, was discipline. Composing is hard work, disciplined work. You don't get around.
So how did this figure into Cage's own life, this life of discipline?
Well, he's the hardest working person I've ever known anything about. He worked morning, noon, and night constantly. I mean, just I've never known anyone to work that way. Also, the kind of composing he did required not just very intense concentration and very, very, very minute work. It's hard to imagine anyone, hard for me to imagine anyone, devoting that much time so intensely to such minute work, really.
Now, we should talk some about John Cage's innovations. For instance, he came up with something called the prepared piano.
Henry Cowell, the composer, who was a good friend of Cage, someone Cage respected very much, had once put some kind of metal pan on top of the keys of a piano to get a sort of tittering effect. And I think he also plucked a string with a needle point or something like that. Cage heard that and was very influenced by it and took it, you know, about 20 steps further by inserting various objects between the strings of the piano, a rubber eraser or a screw, endless kinds of items, which entirely changed the timbre of the piano and gave it a kind of percussive quality. I mean, he made the piano sound like a new instrument, which it really became. And what he said about it was that now someone sitting at the piano can be a whole percussion orchestra, just producing all these percussive sounds together. This is quite wonderful, all those early prepared piano pieces. He certainly did not want his reputation to rest on that. And I mean, he worked with a prepared piano maybe a half dozen years, something like that, and then really gave it up.
So did he find the conventional piano too limiting?
I think it isn't that so much as Cage's audiophilia. Cage loved sound. That's the basic thing, it seems to me, about Cage. He loved sound. I mean, in a way that I don't know anyone else who does. In European American music, the range of sounds is actually extremely limited. I mean, the world is full of sound. And Cage wanted to bring new sound into music. It's ridiculous to think that music can be organized only by, you know, the scale, the European classical scale, A, B, C, D, F, G. He wanted to bring all kinds of new sounds into music.
Well, and it seems that maybe there wasn't such a clear distinction in his mind between what was music and what was sound, and because virtually anything that we experience in the world, anything that we can hear, could conceivably be worked into a musical composition.
That's true, except the distinction for him simply was that music was what he called organized sound. It's not just, just sound. It's, as he calls it, organized sound. And he found various ways, you know, of organizing all kinds of new sounds, sounds that really no one had ever listened to.
Like what kinds of sounds that people hadn't heard before?
The needle of a cactus being plucked.
Wow.
That's one of his sounds. He wanted to really get the sounds of mushroom spores dropping, all kinds of sounds in Cage. One of the most beautiful expressions of that, I think, is his pieces for what he called ambient sound, what it sounds like to be, let's say, in Madison or in New York, what's in the air. Cage, in one case, he went to Ireland and he recorded all over Ireland, you know, just different sounds that he heard here and there and there and there, and organized them all together in this wonderful Irish piece called Roratorio. It's just wonderful to listen to. I mean, to me, it's just delightful. You've never heard this stuff before.
Is that the nocturne?
And he also had a philosophy about how to put this together, and probably various strands of philosophy. For instance, he was, in the early 50s, very drawn to notions of chance, and particularly stemming from the classic Chinese text, the I Ching. Can you tell me about that?
Well, that's right. Cage was very interested in Oriental thinking and Oriental music. For a while, he studied Buddhism at Columbia University with the famous Zen teacher, Daisetsu Suzuki, who became a close friend of Cage's. As a way of organizing sound, also, he relied on a book called the I Ching, which is a 3,000-year-old book of Chinese divinations. You roll some coins or something, and that leads you to a hexagram, so-called, in the I Ching, which has a message for you, which supposedly is the answer to the question you're raising. And Cage used the I Ching, you know, sort of impersonally, rolling things, get to this ideogram, get to that ideogram, and start putting together ideas from these ideograms. So not just one or two, but hundreds, you know, hundreds and hundreds of them put together for a piece. That is, he wanted to keep himself out of it. You know, that was the impersonal thing.
Why did he want to keep himself out of it?
It's a good question. I mean, you would ask also, why did T.S. Eliot want to keep himself out of it, or why did James Joyce want to keep himself out of it? I think they just thought so much of 19th century romantic writing was just schmaltzy, you know? It was a pain to hear about this one's wounds and yelps and cries and I'm sorry. You know, it was too much. The 20th century wasn't like that. It was an industrial time. It was hard-edged. And there was the war. We heard enough about suffering and everything, sort of wanted to get away from it.
Now, between 1952 and 1953, John Cage pursued a huge project that he called the Williams Mix. What was this?
Yes. Oh, unbelievably complicated tape piece that he worked on together with Earl Brown, another composer. They sat splicing tape. The chance directions told him, you know, how large a slice of tape to use.
Which is very hard to do for anyone who's actually worked with tape. I mean, to manipulate that physical material and to, you know, not lose it.
Well, they worked just absolutely day and night. I mean, really, really, really day and night on it. I mean, smoking old butts. He and Earl Brown sat across from each other on a table with these loops of tape and hundreds of envelopes. The envelopes had different notes and different subjects in them, and the I Ching told them which note to go to, which subject to go to. It's all put together by chance. And these little micro tapes, and you put them all together, really sounds quite wonderful. You've just never heard anything like this before.
And you suggest in your book that the difficulty itself was part of the appeal for John Cage.
Oh, no question. I've never known anyone with such an appetite for complexity. Yeah, absolutely. He loved swimming in the most intense difficulty. They had a kind of social content, too. He also wrote a set of violin pieces that he said were unplayable. I mean, they're so incredibly complex, and nobody could ever play them. In fact, they have been played, and they're very, very wonderful. But one of his thoughts there was that if he could show that the unplayable was really playable, maybe we could achieve something like peace, you know? People think there can't be peace. Maybe people can really do the impossible, was really his point. I must say, you know, after working with Cage, he really taught me how to listen to music, which I had never done. Now I listen. I'm very careful. I'm listening hard to what it is that I'm hearing, and I hear all kinds of things I had never heard before that if I were just sitting back and hearing it. You know, it's the point of his famous 4:33, this famous silent piece that he wrote. 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence, you know. He had it divided into three movements, I guess, and the pianist would sit silently at a piano with the keyboard open, close it after the first movement, the keyboard after the first one. Then he would open it, you'd have the second movement, nothing, playing nothing, close it after the second movement, sit there, open it, and play the third movement. Cage's point, of course, was that there was no silence there at all. The atmosphere was filled with sound. People were just not listening. For Cage, there was no avoiding sound. Everything has sound. Everything has sound.
Hmm. Now, this has become an iconic piece, 4:33, but it wasn't that well received at first, was it? I mean, when it was performed as a premiere in 1952 in Woodstock, New York?
Well, I guess not. I mean, it's always been made a lot of fun of, and in fact, it's been made much, much, much too much of. People should listen to Cage's, his concert for piano and orchestra, and they should talk about that instead of talking about 4:33. It was a little thing, just a little lesson that he was making, but of course it stuck and it got a lot of publicity.
Supposedly, I mean, legend has it that someone in the audience afterwards said, you know, we should run these people out of town.
I think so, yes. Very good. Okay. It's hard to say that about any other American composer, I think.
Yeah. You know, what I find fascinating about thinking about Cage's work is that he celebrated chance. He celebrated sort of just things happening the way they might in the real world, and yet he was meticulous about the way he organized things. For instance, he didn't just want someone to perform one of his pieces and just do whatever they wanted with it. I mean, this was not the anything goes aesthetic. It was quite the opposite.
Oh, it was exactly the opposite. I mean, as I said, what he said he learned from Arnold Schoenberg was discipline. He expected people to take the music very seriously, no matter how complex the violin sonatas were. He expected the performer to absolutely respect the score and play everything exactly right.
At the end of your book, you write that Marcel Duchamp's widow, Tini Duchamp, described John Cage's sensibility in 5 words. He loved everything and nothing.
Yeah, that's good.
Does that sum up Cage's sensibility?
Yes, I think so. What I mean simply is that for his terrible passion and dedication and intense work, the way he worked, and then he gets a new idea, he gives up the earlier idea entirely and starts off on something entirely new, doesn't return to the other thing at all. Deeply in love, drops it, goes on to something else, deeply, deeply in love with it, forget it, next thing.
Kenneth Silverman is the author of Begin Again, a biography of John Cage. He spoke with Steve Paulson. And this is John Cage's Concert for Piano and Orchestra.